that I think is the absolute limit on anybody thinking about cities in this setting. At the end of this hour, I don't want to hear the word urban again for the next week. Some of it, I guess, I just can't escape from. I bring it with me. But I am amazed that there are even a smattering of folks around who want to think a little bit about cities in this setting. We yesterday were all over the map, and I'm going to continue that precedent today. I apologized yesterday, not really apologized, but explained that after being around here for a week or 10 days, it seemed to me that this place does generate a kind of a scattershot method of discussion of issues, and I'm fairly at home with that. The city does not seem to me to be a discrete set of packages that you sort of wrap up and present, but rather a locus in which to raise some mostly unanswerable questions. And so I will want to continue to raise mostly unanswerable questions this morning, with the focus a little bit more on the future that we face in our cities, and at least in the United States. What we did yesterday, to refresh some of your memories and just review slightly for those of you who weren't here yesterday morning, is to talk a little bit about the city in history, establishing quite basically the point that cities and civilization are essentially equivalents, that one doesn't think about civilization without thinking about cities, and that one doesn't think about our culture, our kind of, particularly our kind of advanced technical culture, without thinking clearly about the dependency upon cities that we all experience in our everyday life, even at Holden. We talked some about the emergence of cities through history in various kinds of stages. The last major transition we talked about had to do with the still little understood, I think, transition from the industrial city to the mass service city. We may want to talk a little bit more about that this morning. We talked about cities as the place, as at least these days, place of extremes. For the very rich and the very poor, for the very old and the very young, to some degree, that the middle ground of the culture is that part of the culture which is less at home in the cities than any other part of the culture. And then we quickly covered at least 6 months of material in some talk about issues around racism, around work, around planning, around the future of neighborhoods, and around justice, and surfaced what at least I see as the major, some of the major problems in each of those areas that face us when we think about those. This morning, I want to hold myself back from spending the whole hour, as I just about did yesterday, so that we have some time to throw some stuff around. I want to describe very briefly five major themes or trends that I think are already evident in the development of cities in America, and which will to some degree define our ballpark for the 1980s, and think a little bit about the problems which these five themes or trends raise for us, most of which are kind of obvious, I think. Then I want to talk a little bit, very, very briefly, about the two major related agendas for Christians working in cities that I see as paramount. And finally, I just want to end this morning anecdotally on a slightly upbeat note. I find it sometimes difficult to be upbeat about cities, but there are some fascinating things that are new going on in cities, and I just want to tell a couple stories about some of those things, and maybe you can multiply them by large factors. Okay, what do we got going on in cities for the next decade? Five major things. Number one, we've learned in the last couple of years that the very question of the survival of inner cities is at issue. When you're dealing with survival questions, we talked yesterday about the difficulty in poor communities of dealing with the questions of access and power and organizing poor people when questions of survival on the individual level are so paramount in folks' lives. The same thing is true of cities. How in the world do you think about a city in terms of quality, in terms of constituency, for whom are cities operating, much less get to questions of why cities, reconstructing cities along lines that enhance life, when the survival issue is so paramount and central. My guess is that more cities than just Cleveland and New York are very close to the edge of the financial brink. Chicago is often looked at, my town is often looked at as a town that has a sound financial base and is nowhere near where Cleveland and New York are. Well, that just ain't true. There are all kinds of mechanisms that urban managers use to conceal or postpone financial crises, and our late King Daley was incredibly good at using various mechanisms to conceal financial crises. There is, underlying the financial kind of dilemma that at least inner cities find themselves in is the whole question of the shifting of the financial structure of cities. Clearly, cities are being asked to do things that nobody else in the country is being asked to do in terms of taking care of large dependent populations. It's ridiculous to talk about comparing the tax structure of middle class or affluent suburbs or small towns with the tax structure and needs of cities when you've got up to half of the population and sometimes more folks living at or below the poverty level in cities. That is a whole structure of dependency that is really not in many ways the city's fault, but that cities are being asked to bear. Along with that is at least in the Northeast and Midwest, we talked yesterday about the massive flight of the industrial base out of the cities. My guess is the little I know about the Southwest and the Sun Belt, where many of them are going, that the location of industry in those towns tends to be outside the city limits, and so there are tax-based kinds of questions that are not being helped much by the recipient cities, or for the recipient cities, by the flight of industry down that direction. The exodus, the continued exodus of the solid working class ethnic groupings and the middle class out of the inner cities has meant that there has been, over the last 15 or 20 years, a decline in both property values and home ownership, and so yet another source of income is fleeing. The problem of financial survival for cities is magnified for me many times when I think about the infrastructure of cities. And this is a sort of hidden thing in cities. But the building that goes on under the pavement in a town, like especially in our older cities, under New York sidewalks and under Chicago's, is probably more elaborate and more complex and more expensive than the building that goes on above the ground. In the older towns, in the older cities in this country, that business underneath the ground is rapidly decaying. An engineering survey in New York this spring, after spending a couple of years looking and poking around in the tunnels and stuff underneath, and looking at sewage and looking at water supply and looking at the electrical stuff underground, looking at the transport tunnels and so on underground, concluded that it would take something like $5 billion a year simply to keep the relatively decayed underground infrastructure of that city at its present point. And that in order to get it back to where it was when it was constructed would take something on the order of $20 to $25 billion expended over a period of a year or two. So we're dealing not only with the question of survival on the surface and above in the air, we are dealing with cities built over decades on necessary structures. Cities are artificial environments. On that artificial stuff that is going to pot. Along with the survival question, and I suppose really as a subset of it, but I'll treat it real briefly as a separate point, is the clear decay of and absolute failure of all of the major institutions of city life. It is clear that only exceptionally do schools in cities, public schools in cities, educate. Only exceptionally do public transportation networks adequately move people and goods. Only exceptionally do the structures of housing and living work in ways that make sense. As we looked at various issue areas yesterday, one of the words that continually came up was insanity, to sort of describe what we're looking at. The publicly funded sets of institutions which bind together the functioning of the city are in trouble. We know about those. We know about those severally. Most of us work maybe on one or two of them at a time. But when you think about the confluence of the structural problems in a city and the functioning of the institutions in that town, in most any city, we are in a good deal of trouble. Thirdly, and this one I'm fascinated by and not clear on at all. Somehow in the next decade, we're going to be working with whatever the implications are of the emergence of a mass service city. Insofar as cities are seen now to be on the rebound, what is meant by that is that the downtowns of cities are being given a facelift. What's happening structurally there? Basically, large private and public services, banks, insurance companies, large public bureaucracies, state buildings, federal buildings, and so on, hotels, convention centers, are being built in the major downtown areas where we see cities that are coming back to life. That means some things. The nature of the stuff that's going up in downtown American cities these days, it seems to me, has shifted, and I don't know what it means. For one thing, it's global. The interest of downtown urban America is no longer the metropolitan region or the agricultural region for which that city was once the center for trade and markets and so on, but tends to be more and more national and transnational in its thinking of its service area, whether we're thinking about federal bureaucracies or whether we're thinking about multinational headquarters of corporations, multinational corporation headquarters. We're thinking about institutions whose priorities and decisions are not made really on the basis of what a city needs or even the region needs, but on the basis of factors which are far beyond the city boundaries. That's going to mean some stuff, and I'm not sure what it's going to mean. Along with the reclamation of the downtown areas for the mass service city, we talked a little bit yesterday about the gentrification movement, about the reclamation of the central city, formerly slum areas, for the middle class. Clearly, the workforce needed by the new mass service city downtown is a workforce that is not poor, not black, not Latin, but is made up of folk like us in this room. And therefore, it is in the interest of that structural set to make sure that both as workers and as consumers of the retail business, it's still important for downtown, that those cities immediately around the core, those neighborhoods immediately around the core, be reclaimed from the poor. That raises lots of questions, not only questions about what happens to the folks whose neighborhoods those once were, but also I think more complexly questions about this, something maybe we can call the suburbanization of downtown. These are people being brought into the central cities who have all of the characteristics that we used to think about in terms of suburbs. These are people who are mobile, whether upwardly or not. They at least will change jobs an awful lot during their lifetimes. They are people who are interested in a private spot. They're interested in a little green. They're interested in all kinds of green, actually. They're interested in the consumption values. And those are different kinds of interests that than used to define old-style ethnic or tightly knit urban communities. I'm wondering, you know, one of the things I'm wondering, I guess, and I talked a little bit about it yesterday, is whether or not what effect bringing basically anti-urban biases into downtown cities is going to have. One of the other components of the of this reclamation of the inner core neighborhoods, of course, is the reinforcement of the class separation in major cities. More and more neighborhoods that you run across in lots of towns are integrated racially. But as the slogan goes in Mark Twain's community, Hyde Park, integration means black and white together against the poor. That often is what's happening in close-in neighborhoods as well. And the poor then in lots of cities are inheriting the old working class white areas as the working class whites then move out to the near-in suburbs whose housing stocks built immediately after World War II are rapidly deteriorating, so you have obviously a lot of money being made on all of this turnover stuff. So we have the question of the homogenization of the central cities. The poor is out, the poor are out. Some of what we mean by city, richness, the inner, we talked about the definitions of cities yesterday in terms of the interaction of all of the possible roles of humanity. Some of that variety may be out. We may be seeing, as a consequence of homogenizing the inner city, a kind of a vast construction of suburban malls downtown, and that is what people think about when they think about downtown. Minneapolis is already there. Okay, fourth, it seems to me that we will probably see what I think has proceeded already a good deal down the pike, and that is an erosion of public power at the city level. From the outside, it may sound quite ironic that somebody out of Daly City would Mayor Daly's city will be talking about the erosion of public power, and I'm certainly not just talking about the death of King Richard. I'm talking about the increasing powerlessness of city government to deal significantly with any of the aspects of urban problems. If you listen to the statements out of the National Conference of Mayors, for instance, one of the themes that just hits you in the face time and again is the utter dependency of city government upon forces that really it cannot do more than nudge and certainly cannot control. The two greatest examples of that dependency, of course, are the increased budgetary dependency on the federal government, and increasingly, along with the downtown mass service developments, a dependency on private industry. All of you are looking at cities that where the only argument is how much of a tax break to give private industry in order to come in to the city. How much concession do we need to give? I am not at all certain that governing a city in the sense that we might mean setting a direction and then implementing it is any more possible. City governments, I think, can retard the process of giving away the city to other interests a little bit, but that the city is being given away to other interests, to broader institutional settings, is, I think, clear to me. Along with that, maybe the frightening thing for citizens of the city, that is a basic shrinkage of public discussion space. Fewer and fewer issues are even able to be addressed in the public sphere. More and more issues are decided by technically determined kinds of considerations, so that the area in which people can be citizens, I think, is shrinking dramatically and frighteningly. Five, and here you can help me. I just don't know. Something in the next decade is going to impact cities around the question of the beginnings of scarcity. Energy is certainly what is on all of our minds at the moment, but we may, if lots of our prophets are correct, be facing a lot more areas of scarcity than simply our oil supply. This, again, like all of these areas, seems to me to be a kind of two-edged sword filled with both possibilities and with dangers. It certainly could, scarcity in energy, for instance, certainly could make cities increasingly chaotic places, or they could contribute to the regeneration of city life. Decisions around the place of the neighborhood, about the mass transit kind of questions, all of these, I think, are going to be increasingly affected by scarcity questions, and we can maybe talk about a little bit in a minute what those questions might be. Well, I think that the Christian citizen in a city always carries with him or her two major agendas that ought to inform our work, the problem always is to try to figure out what the context is that we're working on these two major agendas, but I don't think our agendas have changed. One is the justice agenda, and the other is something that I can vaguely call the meaning agenda. One is quantitative. We need, and cities are the place where we are taught that the needs are clearly the greatest. The justice agenda, the quantitative agenda, the equality agenda, the distributive agenda, the inclusion agenda, the creation of access kind of priority for folks is clearly still there. And that includes all of our thinking about race and class and work and so on. The other agenda, the meaning agenda, the quality agenda, the what makes life worth living kind of agenda, seems to me exciting, maybe, for the future of cities. Maybe we're coming to a time when urban life might be the place where quality of life can be best addressed. That's a little bit ironic to think about at Holden, but a couple of instances. One of the things that strikes our mainly small town or suburban students when they come through the city is the strength and attractiveness of urban community. My guess is that only in occasional small rural villages in the United States do you find the feel for community that you do in lots of urban neighborhoods even today. Some of the Waverly group, Dave was saying, some teenagers from Waverly go into Cabrini Green even, a large all-black public housing project on Chicago's north side, and come away absolutely amazed at the network of human interaction and caring that happens in a public housing project. To be guided around a public housing project by a woman who knows everybody and knows all about everybody's lives, and to see the kind of interdependence that is just assumed by people in those kinds of communities, partly out of survival needs, but partly because is the way that individuals find their meaning in community. That's real attractive to lots of our students, and it may become more attractive to more of us. Obviously, the other dimensions of the quality and meaning question have to do with the place of the city as still as the only scale of social organization that can support the lively life of the mind, the lively arts, whether community generated or downtown generated. Still, in many ways, the city making sense as the only place where that kind of quality and variety can be injected into our lives. I'm not sanguine about either the justice agenda or the meaning agenda as we work into the 80s, but it seems to me that those may well be what we have to be about. Finally, let me just tell a couple of stories about on a more hopeful note, okay? Because one of the things that you do see is stuff that is most fetching and that turns things on its head going on in cities these days. You can multiply this list many times. I want to talk about an example in the political sphere, in the economic sphere, in the sort of technological sphere, in healthcare, in talk a little bit about the arts and a little bit about religion, and that's chomp, and that's not going to be long. In the political sphere, one of the most interesting kinds of experiments in Chicago, and to some degree, Chicago is a wonderful town for political experimenting, simply because of the closed nature of the political system for so many years. If you weren't born into the political machine in Chicago, you had to go around it and invent other ways of surfacing a political agenda. So it's no accident that Chicago is the headquarters for all kinds of community organizing groupings and Saul Alinsky and lots of other folks grew up on the streets of Chicago trying to get around this closed structure politically. In the electoral ballpark, one of the most interesting experiments goes on with a guy named Dick Simpson in a ward of Chicago, a neighborhood of Chicago, 60,000 residents or so. It's an experiment in radical representative government. Simpson gets the agenda for the city council meeting. City council in Chicago functioning primarily as a rubber stamp, so that Simpson is using his office for something else here, as you'll see. Gets the agenda, surfaces the issues with representatives from every group that he can find in the city, churches, block clubs, businesses, everything that he can find in his neighborhood. They come together on a biweekly basis. Simpson lays out the issue, has a debate over the substance of the issue. The ward assembly votes, and Simpson never votes his own feelings. He always votes what the citizens of that ward tell him to vote. You can talk a lot about, you know, the abrogation of individual conscience in political office holders. That certainly is a problem, but that kind of a building in of a participatory mechanism for an urban neighborhood seems to me at least an interesting thing to look at. In the economic realm, one of the most fascinating things that has unfolded in urban America that I know about in the last 5 years has been an experiment with a bank. A community board bought a bank in Chicago's South Side and South Shore, the community immediately south of Hyde Park, inheriting a community which all of the signs said was on the way down and would be a slum within 5 to 10 years. The community had lots of problems, but also, as lots of those older communities do, a marvelously stable kind of housing stock that could be regenerated. Was it possible, some people thought, to take over a major financial institution in a neighborhood and make it work for something besides ripping off every possible buck as the neighborhood went its inevitable way downward? South Shore Bank operates not on a profit motive. They make a profit, but they cut it back. And they talk about profit in terms of community agenda. They need a profit to keep the bank going and to meet all of the federal regulations which charter banks, and to generate capital for their own work, but they define the bottom line in a way which includes development. In South Shore so far, it's working. It's the only bank I know of which has as its largest department a community development department. And what those bankers do is they spend time on the streets. Whoever heard of bankers spending time on the streets? They go from building to building, from door to door. They talk to folks about their financial situation, about what it would take to bring buildings up to code, about what kinds of loans were possible to make. It's a different kind of approach, and clearly not too many people trained in the University of Chicago Business School to be bankers would find this very orthodox or appealing. But in this case, putting one's hand on a major financial resource in the center of a community seems to be working in interesting ways. Technologically, lots of the problems that I have had with the whole alternative technology kind of movement, the small is beautiful stuff, has been that it's that it seems to be A, Californian, and B, therefore, maybe, limited to a certain segment of the adventurous, lifestyle-y middle class who are willing to sort of try new gimmicks. And, you know, I like windmills on farms, and I think probably it's a good thing that they are used to produce electricity. But a lot of this stuff has had difficulty translating into more complicated urban settings. Well, in Chicago, we've had now for a couple of years, we've been working on a on a place called the Center for Alternative Technology, the aim of which is simply to take some of the interesting stuff that's being thought about, mostly not in cities, and translate it into terms that make sense in urban America. So lots of stuff is going on that you would recognize if you're into any of the interesting alternative technologies that's not in urban America. How do you adapt solar to apartment building neighborhoods? How do you think about use of garden spaces when you don't have much space? How do you think about cooperative methods for producing and distributing goods? Interesting place. And it's high time the translation of new technologies, appropriate technologies in Schumacher's terms, into city stuff takes place. Healthcare. Lots of times in cities, communities, neighborhoods have been all too willing to say our problems, I talked about this a little bit last week, our problems are exclusively a lack of access to those institutions which could serve us better than they do. So if health is bad in a community, what we need is a hospital and more doctors, right? That's, or at least a healthcare or a facility of some kind, a clinic or something. A group of us a few years ago went out into a black community where we knew a lot of folks and where there was clear health problems and lots of beginning organizing activity for a new health clinic. What we decided to do was to say, what's the problem here? What do we mean by sickness in this community? What would health mean? All of that led to a fairly complicated community self-survey where the community really looked at what was the matter with their health, basically a poor black community. Well, it turned out some very interesting things were the matter with their health, the largest number of people who needed medical care were victims of dog bites and victims of automobile accidents, kids playing in the streets and so on. Well, if you think about those two things, and then a third category was nutritional inadequacy. You just run down. If you think about those kinds of things, it may be that the last thing in the world that community needed was a new health clinic and lots more doctors to treat symptoms of something. So the community started to rethink what the solution was to the problem when the problem had been restated and came up with lots of interesting things like stop signs where there weren't any and stoplights where there weren't any, lots of fights about that. A marvelous bounty system in which most of the teenagers in the community were given rewards for stray dogs, which was a huge problem in the community, that were rounded up, and within a couple of months, all of these packs of dogs that were going around biting people were rounded up. And the community began to look at its rooftops and plant gardens. A number of people with some agricultural skills came out and did the greenhouse business on block after block out there. Now you see green rooftops. Some cities that's normal. In Chicago it had not been. There was an abandoned school building which was no longer useful for anything else, but in the basement had a swimming pool which had been emptied years ago. Well, they sort of damp and dank down there. They went down there, and part of the swimming pool is now a fish pond, and another part of that basement area down there is a mushroom farm. So that structures of self-sufficiency began emerging from this neighborhood rather than increased structures of dependency. Okay?
How big would you say the neighborhood?
West Garfield Park is probably 50,000, 55,000 people. Interestingly, the superstructure for this was a grouping of churches. Let me just say a word about one other area that seems to me to be absolutely marvelously optimistic at this point in urban life, and that is the flowering of the arts in the cities. It seems to me that we are in an exciting renaissance period in the arts in our cities at this point. And I don't know, this may be one area where I see absolutely no two-edged sword at work, nothing but thankfulness. Not only the major arts institutions in most of our cities are doing much more than surviving, but thriving and thinking about how to broaden their outreach and audience and so on and so forth. But in cities that I go to all across the country, the flowering of experimental and community-based arts groups in theater, in the visual arts, in poetry, in music, is just astounding. Just astounding. And I can't read that anything but optimistically. And it's part of the building blocks, I suppose, we have as we begin to think about the quality of life question and agenda in the 80s. Finally, I think that there are some things that can be said about the nice things that some churches are doing in cities. I hate to be too complimentary to churches. I think basically, you know, that American Protestantism and increasingly Catholicism, as their constituency moves out, has failed utterly in any sense of Christian mission in the cities. And you know, the number of abandoned church buildings as the church follows its class out into neighborhoods and so forth is still just astounding. So the record, I think, on the whole, is not something we ought to be patting ourselves on the back for. On the other hand, there are some interesting exceptions to that rule, and one can only hope that they will multiply. Walt and others, Ohioans around here, know about a grouping in Cleveland called Lutheran Metropolitan Ministries, which in a day when congregations really are not to be had, at least for the asking, for newly graduated seminary people, in other words, seminary folks are finding difficulty getting jobs. One of the things that this grouping of clergy and lay people do in Cleveland is to provide clear ways of thinking about alternative ministries, worker priests kind of stuff, with a staff of about 15 or 20, mostly clergy at this point. They are into everything in Cleveland in terms of organizing, in terms of social welfare stuff, food cooperatives, neighborhood involvement, and so on. Interesting kind of multifaceted model for church involvement in the cities. And let me just stop there. Those are some stories that give me hope, that give me some reason to want to go back to the city after Holden Village, that are some building blocks that I anyway think, as we attack both the justice and the quality of life agenda for the 1980s in cities, we can use them. Let me just end. Comments, questions, Bill?
I heard an idea a few weeks ago that perhaps the largest effective manageable size would be something on the order of 500,000 or so, and that perhaps for the future of cities there would have to be some way of grouping into units no larger than that. How does that strike you?
As complicated. I talked a little bit yesterday about the pull between localism and regionalism in the urban centers. And both somehow seem to be necessary. I'm not sure that in terms of community creation and paying attention to participation in the political process and decision making, that 500,000 is a lot too big. That some people, Milton Kotler and others, argued that the decentralization move has to really come down to a much smaller unit than that. that's complicated for me because I think that there are clearly some things in urban life that can be handled at that level, and there's a whole other set of things that need to be handled at units larger than cities.
Yes.
Right? I'm not sure the intermediate ground, that is city government, is very viable anymore. That's one of the things that I could have talked about of the diminishment of public power at the city level. Some stuff, you know, all the stuff we learned from the Black community on local control of schools, on local accountability of police, on fire protection kind of stuff, the local, you know, a lot of that stuff can be localized, can be controlled at the neighborhood levels, and I think better controlled than at the city level. Lots of other stuff having to do with technical aspects of, you know, air and water and transport in a larger setting need to be, I think, handled at a level higher than cities. So we're sort of left with this middle ground of city government that is not appropriate for any kinds of decisions in lots of ways. Foxy.
Yeah, as a private citizen that tries to screw you around and do a little bit of the citizen's business, I become very frustrated when I work on a land use plan for 4 or 5 years, which I've just done, only to discover that the 6-year road plan was sort of kind of put on us. They took it after they talked to the citizens. They took the information of what kind of neighborhoods we would like to keep or have or make down to the Public Works Department, and they just butchered it. And we looked at that and said, hey, man, we told you that we don't want 4-lane roads. They said, well, we can't get any money from the state to build anything unless we make it 4 lanes. That's the standard the state has. Go down and tell your officials in Olympia. Fine, we run right down there and they hand you a little brochure and tell you how come they have to have 4-lane road, because it's safer, it's better, and we stand there and we say, yeah, but a 2-year-old can't get across to their friends, you know, or a 4-year-old or whatever. And they might as well build a 10-foot wall and put a 4-lane road there. The kids can't get across. Neither can the housewives and want to go and talk to their neighbors. Everything is for the car. So, and I'm out in, I'm 8 miles outside of the city, but in a very old, small town.
Yeah.
It's not incorporated. So it's very frustrating because they don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
As one man said before the commissioners, everybody hated the planner. He felt sorry for the planner, because everybody in the whole committee hated the planner. Well, it may not be quite true, but...
Close to it.
Yeah, close to it.
One more illustration of the kind of dependency of cities on forces beyond themselves to deal with.
And for some reason, the planners and they seem to feel that it is our solemn duty in this small community, which is, as I said, old, and it's a very diverse community. We've got military, which come and go quickly. We have apartments. We have big institution, VLU. It's a big institution for that small of a community. And yet, they didn't take into account even Pacific Lutheran because it didn't show up on the census records. There's all kinds of funny things that happen when they're planning. They couldn't get any statistics because the students don't actually live there. You know, they live someplace else. They don't show up on census records. So they did all the computerization through the University of Washington computer and came out with all these fancy things that we need or want and all that. And then they had a survey in the community and everything, which did not include, what is it, 2,300 students? It's incredible. And I can't get PLU to do anything either.
Yeah. Paul. Paul,
within the last 35 years, the world has had the unusual horror and privilege of seeing half a dozen or more of its major cities practically leveled to the ground, and they've been rebuilt. Do you have any comments to make as to whether or not the errors that have accumulated in these cities over the centuries have been corrected in the rebuilding so that we have some indication that there can be hope in man's rebuildings?
How about some other people? Other people been?
Remember European cities? London, of Tokyo, Nagasaki, of Hiroshima.
Dresden. Other people visited those places recently? I have not. Walt?
One of the things I wanted to ask was whether or not the North European experience of the city can teach us anything. I found German cities, at least when I was there, to be marvelously civilized places. On the other hand, the English cities, I spent 3 months in an English city, they were ghastly. They were worse than anything I had experienced here. I don't know whether there's a difference in culture, attitude. England obviously had a different kind of cultural development than Germany and Scandinavia did. But I had no fear of the city, no horror, no revulsion of the city in Germany. Can anything be learned from that?
Is it true that they are practically slums?
German cities, yes.
Why is it?
But they haven't solved all the problems. There's one area in Hamburg that houses 30,000-40,000 people in a very small area. It was designed to be rather inclusive in the sense that it wouldn't have to depend upon anything else. But in the process, they made one slight error. For 30,000 people, they have a recreation area the size of a football field. And, that's one of the things that somebody forgot about. And it's caused quite a few problems.
One of the things that impressed me, however, also was the lack of mobility in German society generally. And so that it was a fairly tightly structured culture with clear class lines based largely on education and not much mobility, a large degree of sort of cultural acceptance of one's class and status in life.
And that, you're talking about social and economic mobility as well as geographic mobility. That is, people tend to stay where they are.
Right. Yeah. Both kinds of mobility lacking. The life of the German people that I knew was fairly dull. It works, but it's fairly dull. You work 11 months, you have a month's vacation, you go to the same place for your vacation every year. The daily routine is always the same. The son becomes what the father does. There didn't seem to be any sort of opening out. I could predict Eckhard Fabian's life by looking at his father's.
Yeah.
It was just that simple. So we have mobility, but with it comes insanity, chaos.
Well, when they're aversion to change, though, do they rebuild their cities better, or do they repeat what they had before?
They were not badly built to start with. I lived in a 300-year-old building. I had my room in that 300-year-old building. There was no thought of tearing down that building to make way for something better. You didn't need to. Mm-hmm. Marvelously well the way it was. Big, thick walls, and I watched them building their buildings after the war. Same way. They're going to last 300 more years if they don't have a bomb drop on them.
What you're saying then is that they didn't make the same mistakes in building and designing their cities as we have made in building and designing ours. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they come out of a very different historical era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really an apples and oranges kind of case. That's not to say there's not a lot to learn from them.
One of the things about German cities is they are not built for the automobile.
That's right.
It was absurd to try to watch an American army officer driving a boat into Heidelberg. Mm-hmm. And in Assisi, it was absolutely forbidden. You had to park the car. Rotenburg, similarly. You just had to park the car, walk in. The cities that I saw there were built for pedestrian traffic, bicycle traffic, very small car traffic. And that's it. And
how do they get their goods into the city? Not by large truck, huh?
not by large truck. I have a picture.
Train?
So interesting. I have a picture in Assisi of a mule that had on its back two large containers into which they were shoveling dirt. A dump donkey, one would call it. also another mule carrying wood. You know, you just bring the mule in, unload the wood, go get another load. Marvelous. I guess I love that kind of life, sure. But it obviously isn't designed to move vast quantities of material or people. Public transportation, again, well-developed, very useful. I never thought of owning a car. For 3 years, I never thought of owning a car. Useless. Appendage. So it may well be, to respond to the concern that you were raising earlier, that the energy business is going to do us a great favor. Sure. We'll be stuck with obsolete highways, like we're stuck with canals in Ohio that are now unused. But so what? We may well become a more civilized community. Once.
Sure. Make them all on the tennis courts.
Like Berlin
tennis
court.
Bicycles. One more.
Paul?
Berlin wasn't rebuilt on this medieval plan, nor were some of the busy industrial cities rebuilt on this medieval plan of donkeys and dirt bags. They're modern cities where things move. Düsseldorf and all was like Hamburg, for example, Hamburg, and Tokyo, and there must be some lesson in all this rebuilding.
But many of the problems of our cities, though, stem less from structural problems and more from social racist problems, economic and racist.
Difficult to sort those out. But certainly we've got, you know, this is a totally different setting in the U.S. Not only are our cities newer than the old cities of Europe, but no other country has dealt with the kind of ethnic mix, racial mix, rapid expansion of economic growth that we have. It really, you know, there is a sense in which talking about American cities is not talking about any place else. And even, you know, the newer cities, what we can learn from the newer cities is a problem for me, Paul, because what our planners have learned from the newer cities is that you build from scratch, mm-hmm. and you plan them. And there are not very many success stories in the U.S. about new towns. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. You know, the distinction between something that is built as a new town, whether Columbia, Maryland, or Park Forest, Illinois, or any of the number of other experiments, the distinction between that and a regular suburb is tough to make. I mean, I don't feel it too much. You know, you can see some things that have obviously been thought through and added. There are bike paths and pedestrian paths, and you don't have to cross over four-lane highways in those places. But I think generally, the New Town movement, which is the translation of the Northern European experience of building cities from scratch, has been, when translated into the United States, by some lights, a failure. Yes?
To change the subject a little bit, but you talked a little bit about power and corruption. One of the things that I guess that I feel some concern about, maybe some aggressive frustration, is the crime and the power of police within the inner cities and where this all fits in into reorganizing. Because it seems to me, in our hometown of Minneapolis recently, we had a whole new thing about the corruptness of the police force, which comes up every so many years. And every city that you're in, within length of time, this surfaces constantly. I would think that would be a big problem in looking at this situation, the problems you see.
I,
cannot but agree.
I don't know if there are any solutions or comments about that, but how you look at that as far as your future.
Well, I've always been interested in notions of community control of the police. I mean, somehow having a military force which is, you know, which sees itself as totally cut off from the community fabric with which it deals, you know, is at the root of some of the problems, I think. You know, certainly police unions are the last who would accept the notion of police forces coming out of the communities which they serve. But more and more people in cities are talking that way about the necessity for that.
The Minneapolis trouble is that they got too involved with the people they're supposed to serve.
Sure, that gets a little cozy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you begin to wonder how much power under Curtis Sherwood lies with the police force,
yeah.
Frankly.
You know, let me just digress for a second. We could spend a whole week mm-hmm. on just the issue of crime. In the city, we find out some very interesting things about crime if you look at it halfway objectively. One, that there are clearly two different issues: the fear of crime and the actual incidence of crime. And usually, they have no relationship to each other, none. That the perception of cities as dangerous places, and neighborhoods as dangerous places, and so on, usually is exactly that—a perception which has nothing to do with the actuality. Just think about your own stereotypes and look at the FBI statistics on violent crime. None of the evil, non-white, northern and midwestern, northeastern and midwestern cities are anywhere near the top 10 in terms of crime. All your safe places are Tucson, Phoenix, St. Petersburg. All of the top 10 cities in terms of the incidence of crime are in the Sun Belt. How much racial stuff and other things are involved in our fears, right, about what big cities do. Other interesting stuff, a famous study a couple of years ago down in Kansas City on the crime issue, comparing neighborhoods which are heavily policed with neighborhoods in which police presence was withdrawn, and what happens to the rate of crime. In other words, can the presence of more police prevent crime? Interestingly enough, the presence or absence of police within certain very broad parameters had nothing to do with the incidence of crime. Police are absolutely irrelevant to crime. Yes?
When I spent a couple of years in Boston, I was just astounded at the education system, as you mentioned, because it's so different from that we're used to in the West. Have you done any work, or has there been work done? I don't understand what the role of the parents are. You know, typical people that keep an education system going, it seems, in a smaller community, are those people who want their children educated. And, you know, while I guess I worry about police problems, it seems to me the educational problems. I mean, it does truly seem that that whole system is ineffective, and that there is so much in the way of private schooling, people who can afford private schools so that they can circumvent that system. But what are the attitudes of people who can afford that better system? Is there a role there that either the church could play or...
Well, you know, I've always had a good deal of trouble with private parochial schools. It is no accident in my mind that the public education system in cities deteriorates at the very same time that it is abandoned to the black and the poor.
Yep.
And those are not coincidental happenings. I would argue that the justice agenda in terms of schooling pretty much should involve people in public schooling, and that the ossification, the frozenness of those education bureaucracies needs to be just busted open. I mean, even if you've got a group of concerned parents, in a lot of cities, there's nothing you can do. The Bowmans have been fighting that in Columbus, which is a nice little, you know, village. In the big towns, it is virtually impossible. You have to work 3 days in Chicago to get into the damn school, just to get through the door, passes and so on. Much less meet with anybody who's got anything to say about what's going on in there. And again, you know, finger pointing is real difficult. You know, there's some sense in which, you know, again, we could spend months talking about the institutional kinds of questions that that raises. Clearly, you've got an awful lot of very dedicated teachers still in that system. Some have given up, but not all, by any means. You've got a lot of parents who are very interested that their kids get educated. You've got kids who are not dumb, who are very capable of learning and being excited. So, you know, it's not a people problem. Something else is going on. And how you shake that thing up enough, you know, sometimes I think that with these major institutions, Fayette was talking in his study of Isaiah this morning about how renewal only comes when destruction is imminent. I certainly think that there are large segments of urban America that just need to be, need to fail, they're already failing, that they need to be, that they need to dismantle themselves or somehow just run up on the rocks and break up. And when at least enough people perceive them as having done that, then it's possible to think maybe about reconstituting them. I'm not sure that with some systems it's possible to do anything but try to make an occasional exception for your kid or a group of kids or tough.
I guess the same question I had last yesterday. Where do you see the changes coming from? Is there any? I know there isn't any one place. When Jan Hansen was here 2 weeks ago, he feels not for the 80s, but for many 50 years in the future, that the only place that has enough big guns to handle the big problems is government, and it's going to be. It's more and more the concentration is going to be going, and he doesn't even look forward to that. Saying, "Hey, it's not exciting." He's kind of scared of the whole thing, but he doesn't see any alternative to that. What do you see?
Well, I think I would, and there's a sense in which I would agree with that. That the expansion of government. Guidance, setting of the boundaries, not only in urban America but for national policy as well, it's going to continue to expand. There's just no doubt that corporate capitalism seems to me to be more and more in trouble and incapable of handling a lot of the social and the social agendas that are appearing. So I would agree with the perspective that the role of government will increase, and I would also agree with the fears that one has about that. I ask the constituency question, I think, from my point of view, slightly differently. I ask the question in cities, where are the potentially mobilizable people who are hurting badly enough but who have the potential for really collectively acting on these questions? Where are those kinds of constituencies that are going to be dealing with both, you know, the private and the public spheres and somehow make them accountable and shape the agenda? I still, there is no other group so isolated and therefore so able to form their own agenda in the country as the Black community. We're in a period right now where there are a lot of problems in the Black community, there are a lot of questions internally that are being debated. That is a constituency that you just have to, though, watch very closely, and if you're interested in change, work with hard in urban America. So I'm interested in that. I am interested very much in sections of the labor movement. It seems to me that the changing nature of work and the changing nature of the people who are working is going to mean a lot. You can't think about New York in the next 10 years without thinking about what's going on with the service employees unions, with the public employees unions. You can't think about city government without thinking about what public employment, which is a hugely growing sector of the economy, is going to mean. So what? How do those folks define themselves, and what do they want out of their cities? The people who actually work at making them run or not run. That's a constituency that I think needs to be paid attention to. Those are just a couple of ways that I would restate that question.
There's just kind of a follow-up question on the same thing. That seems to me that somebody's doing some planning. If one group is making their decisions on what they, like the black community, making their agenda for what is important, they're making their plans as to what's important. How can all these planners be brought together to make an overall plan? I mean, at some place, it's getting too big to just let everything happen the way they want to, the way it wants to. It's somebody, not some person, but it's somehow the plans have to be into an overall plan.
I guess I disagree with the premise of your question, which is that somehow planning is important. It never has been in American life, and it certainly hasn't been in American cities. My notion of how change takes place is through conflict. And my interest in a justice agenda means that I think that people without will put people with up against the wall considerably in the next decades, as they've done in the past, and that it's out of that kind of a conflict that the change happens. Nobody plans that. It's just that the black community, at this point in my mind, still has, to some degree, a monopoly on the justice agenda, or at least the potential capacity to define that. Certainly much better than anybody here, any of us, do. And, that's going to lead to some conflict. I don't see, you don't plan for justice. Justice issues are addressed in the midst of conflict, and there are losers and there are winners in justice struggles. Planners sometimes act as if there are never any losers. And that's just dumb.
Well, isn't something, that the so much of some of the things people want to do are dependent upon federal funds. Okay. So in order to write a grant, write the proposal to get the grant, well, initially money is allocated and then some agency sets up guidelines which, sends you a few degrees off of center. Then there's something about the planners probably get there because they know how to write up those grants to get them allocated. Mm-hmm. But by the time it goes through the system, life is vital and moving. So that by the time it gets approved, you've gone ahead and here it's approved here. And this, this crazy patchwork system of going about things. And that people who learn how to write grants and do it to get approval are not people who are people-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a major technical problem at the local level continually. Mm-hmm. And grants people who are adept at rewording what you want to do into something that will get paid for are wonderful to have around.
Except they usually reword it so that it isn't what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. They have to understand.
We're almost at lunchtime, so feel free to wander out as we'll. Yeah, go ahead.
Not a very clear one, but I'm in trouble. Last night we talked about hunger, and essentially the message that I got from that is that what we need is self-reliance at the local level to solve hunger. Now, you talked about some very interesting kinds of expanded things, gardens on the roof, and so forth, and to me that's self-reliance.
Yeah.
Now, given that tends to be then a very, very important commodity for getting at the kind of things that we're talking about here. But yet when we take a look at the large labor unions, the government and so forth, I see the opposite of self-reliant behavior there.
Sure.
And the way that you bring about self-reliance, at least on an individual basis, is in getting people to think well of themselves, dealing with their own self-confidence and so forth. Is that an issue that the church should be dealing with as a primary cause of some of these other things? How we think of ourselves. I see no movement on the part of any institution in that direction.
Mm-hmm. an interesting point. It's partly a cart and horse question with me. I mean, can you work on self-image and a notion of autonomy that's somehow inbred without some experience of autonomy? And increasingly, we don't experience that.
A good way to cover over poor self-image maybe is the kind of long-range planning that keeps everything nice and under control. It's like talking about the Christian ethic as a growth ethic. And the scriptures don't even talk about that. On the other hand, you know, to be confronted, to enter into crisis, seems to me not very many people can do that unless they really have it together.
That's right.
Inside. And that is more the pattern of daily renewal and, you know, reliance on that kind of thing as far as an ethic rather than this need to kind of package to that time to soften the future.
And maybe that's the real role of the church today.
But not to build self-image self-consciously in some kind of cheap psychological way. That's what I'm saying. You know, I think we've done a little weight, but I think we haven't really gotten people together so that we can confront.
It is lunchtime. Thank you.